Welcome to In Their Own Words, the audio memories of leading members of the British Tennis Journalists Association. In this episode, April Todd, the Social Secretary of the Association, explains how she almost changed the succession line of the Swedish monarchy and also how she gave Björn Borg a tennis lesson.
Well, welcome, April, first female to appear in this esteemed group of British Tennis Journalists Association members. And before we start on your tennis career, can you just explain how you almost ended the succession of the Swedish monarchy?
I have to laugh about that. That was a long time before I was involved in tennis. I was skiing. I was chally girl in Zermatt for a couple of years. And I was skiing down to give my punters tea. And halfway down, I saw this group of five guys looking at a map and they looked a bit lost. So I stopped them and said, can I help you? And they said they wanted to get back to the village. So I said, oh, follow me. And I did say, do you want the hard way or the easy way? And they said the hard way. And without thinking, I just went off, them following behind me. And one of the slopes leading down to the valley or to the village is one of the hardest and toughest in Zermatt. And I just, skimmed off, went off and looked up halfway and saw these five bodies lying on the top of the slope. And I thought, oh my God. So I waited for them to catch me up. And then we slowed down, finally got to the path. And I just said, that path leads to Zermatt. And they said, oh, why don't you join us for a drink? So I had to make a decision of whether to go and give my punters tea or have a drink with these guys. But I had a drink with these guys. And they came up and introduced themselves. One was called Yeye, and he just said, oh, we're from Sweden, and this is Carl Gustaf, who's the future king of Sweden, who you almost killed on the slope. And I just fell about. I thought, oh, my God, whatever. But I have to say, we did become really good friends after that, and I skied a lot with them. And that was my encounter with the Swedish royal family. And I'm not so obviously very friendly with them now, but in those days, we were good mates.
A nice link is the fact that you then got to interview a different type of Swedish royalty, Björn Borg.
I know. I mentioned it to Björn Borg that I bumped into his future king on the slopes, which he was quite impressed by. The way I interviewed Björn was, this was after he had denounced that he was resigning from tennis. And it was a bit of a controversy because his agent was saying, no, he's coming back. And he was saying, no, I'm not. And I found out through a friend of mine who was the PR for the Punta Romana Hotel that he was going to be there for a couple of days, giving a series of clinics as part of his contractual obligations with the hotel. So I immediately got on a flight, got down there, and the PR had arranged an interview. And I went and watched him giving these clinics in just of ordinary shorts and a T-shirt. And suddenly the pro comes up to me with a tennis racket and says, someone's failed to turn up. We've got 20 minutes an empty space. We can't possibly have a nobody there. Here, please take this racket and go and play. I said, no. I'm here to interview Björn Borg. I'm not here to play with him. But I was almost forced to go on court, and that absolutely felt like I sort of looked at him and I said, I'm really very nervous because I've always admired you as a tennis player. I never expected to be on the same court with you. But we had 20 minutes and he did not stop. He made me run from one side of the court and he absolutely made me work very, very hard, deliberately. I was so absolutely exhausted at the end of the 20 minutes. When I went to the net to say thank you, all I could say was, what about my interview?
Fantastic. Well, we'll leave Sweden to one side and get back to how you actually started in tennis. Can you tell us how you first got involved?
Well, I've always been very keen on tennis. I played at school. We had a couple of courts that were in fact opened by Christine Truman, and I was lucky. And when I left school, I felt very connected to tennis and I wanted to find a job in tennis, which was pretty hard to start with. So I actually graduated from university with languages and I got some jobs working in press offices because of my languages. I was able to help out with the foreign press. And so I worked at the US Open and Wimbledon and various other sporting events. And I met, luckily, somebody called Jimmy Jones, who was Angela Buxton's coach. And he was also editor of the tennis magazine. And I asked him whether I could write for the magazine. And he gave me an opportunity at the time. And he also explained to me, or I should say, gave me an hour's introduction into journalism, because I had no idea in those days how you actually wrote articles. So he was a great help. And also, I also worked for World Championship Tennis, Lamar Hunts, and got to know a lot of the players. So that started me off. And I started writing a column called Circuit Chat that developed into April Todd Talking To. And it was that where I used to interview a player a month. And it was that column in Tennis Magazine that caught the eye of the Daily Mail editor, David English, who summoned me to the Mail and just said, he'd like you to work for Female. So I jumped from a magazine to a national newspaper. And it really had to sort of get to know what was going on, standing on your feet, because I hadn't a clue.
And that would have been around, I suppose, Laurie Pinion would have been still very much part of the Mail. And then some great writers have been with the Mail and who would have become your colleagues.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because what David English's idea was to get me to write sporting articles for the Female, so that would encourage the female readers to read the back pages, because they weren't reading enough of the back pages. And now, of course, the Daily Mail is more a female paper than any other newspaper.
And that's down to you, obviously, April.
No, not at all. Not at all. It was just him. It was his forecast that he knew that he had to get hold of women who were interested in sport and didn't read the back pages.
Now, the landscape of coverage of sport in many different areas, both radio, television and written, is now very much part where women writers are clearly seen and also very much commentators. But when you started, it wouldn't have been the case, would it?
No, not at all. I was just thinking about that. When I started, it was like going into a media office or media centre, which was predominantly full of male journalists. I mean, they were all very, very competitive with each other. I had to just write about whatever assignment I was given and whatever commission I had and keep my head down. I just was very friendly with everybody. I knew it was a bit competitive as a profession, but I managed to survive, basically.
And obviously you were then blindsided by somebody who must have come up and said, I've got a fantastic idea. Why don't you join the committee? And here's a job you can have as well. And you eventually became the very important social secretary, which in tennis writers' terms is like herding cats to make sure we all get to the same place at the same time.
You're absolutely right. Well, Nigel Clark and Ron Atkins, who sadly is no longer with us, approached me quite out of the blue. I had no idea what this social secretary entailed. Just asked me if I would like to be opted onto the committee as a social secretary. And I agreed, yeah, quite happily, not having a clue. But then realised that my job was to organise the annual awards lunch, or in those days it was the annual awards dinner dance that Laurie Pinion had started off in the 1950s, and which thankfully Barry Flatman changed to an awards lunch, which was, I thought, would be less work, but in fact it's turned out to be much more, because more and more people are coming to the lunch. And it is like herding cattle in, because you get people emailing you from all kinds of the different sections of the tennis world with all kinds of different requests and inquiries about the lunch. And leading up to the day, I'm absolutely full on. But anyway, it is a success, and we had nearly 200 last year, so that proves the point.
You've brought along a number of stars from stage and screen who love tennis, and have you found that the sport draws in very well-known people who then want to get involved?
I do. And I think they like to be involved in the sport. They like to have a connection. And when I invite them to the awards lunch, sometimes they're absolutely delighted to just be part of the scene, to meet all the guys who write all the articles and find out about tennis and the world of tennis that we are so involved in. They're all keen and passionate tennis players and followers of the sport. And Elaine Page is a classic example. I mean, I play with her quite often, and she often asks me about what's going on. And there are times when I've asked her if she'd come, and she's very happily helped out with our raffle and auction. And once she sang Midnight with Marcus Buckland a few bars, and now, which I thought was delightful. That just shows you someone who's very keen to help out.
And tennis is a big part of your life. You You love Queens as well, don't you? The club and the tournament. It's a key part of the London tennis scene, isn't it, Queens?
Yes, it is. As from my perspective, it's like going to any tennis tournament, but I see my club being completely destroyed as a private club. And as the builders come in, it's like a building site for weeks ahead of the tournament. And then suddenly we are invaded by thousands of people. I mean, we no longer have our facilities or anything taken away from us. But I'm in two camps. I mean, I'm obviously in the media centre, so I'm working and I don't really use my membership there at all, but I can see that it is difficult for members to accept. But on the other hand, they get to see some absolutely amazing matches, so you have to take that into consideration that for 3 months of the year we don't have our club.
It is an amazing transformation, isn't it? You can't believe that this spaceship has landed in your small club.
Absolutely. If you walk into the club without any of the tournament and you see where we park our cars, I kind of point out that that's where the big stands go. This is the centre court, which is a revered court we're not allowed to even tread on. And that overlooks the pavilion. And where we have the two hard courts, which are the US Open surface, is where the other big stand opposite the pavilion is. And it's just amazing what they do and how they do it. And you can't believe that beneath all that is a little private tennis club that has 4,000 members.
But tennis isn't only the sport you absolutely love, golf and Formula One. And you actually gave James Hunter a trophy at one stage.
Yeah, a few years ago. I didn't actually understand who James Hunt was. He just won the race I was in Rouen, and he was driving a Formula 3 race. And that, in those days, I really hadn't a clue about motor racing. I just happened to have a boyfriend in motor racing who'd invited me along. And James Hunt was at the back of the grid and came through the grid and won the race, which absolutely surprised the organisers. So they grabbed me and just said, would you please present the trophy in garland? It was really quite funny because I hadn't a clue. And he came round after he did his triumph lap and got out of the car. I gave him his trophy and I put this garland around the race. And the first words he said to me were, got a fag, love? And I said in my little voice, I was probably about 19 at the time, I said, I don't smoke. Anyway, it's all written up in Shunt because I described it as someone who came out with sweaty, smelly, and I had to kiss him he had to kiss me on both cheeks.
And Bernie Eccleston, you also be involved there.
Yeah, Bernie Eccleston, I did a lot of research into a book about him, a biography, through my connections in the Formula One world. And I came up with quite a lot of interesting facts, which I wrote about. And I got a call from him. Actually, it was during Wimbledon, completely out of the blue this was after it was published. And just said, Bernie Eccleston here, what's all this crap I'm reading? And I immediately thought, Christ, here goes. I said, well, you have the right to reply. So 2 days later, I was in his office chatting away and he explained everything his way, you know, his involvement with the train robbery that everybody believed he was involved with. I got an answer to that. So I wrote it like that. And since then, we became quite good friends. And he used to give me two VIP passes for the British Grand Prix every year.
Very nice, April. Now, your other passion is golf. And it's very interesting, isn't it, that Petter Korda, Australian Open champion, his daughter is now dominating golf. His other daughter is also a fantastic golfer. And his son is in professional tennis. It's a lovely combination of two sports you love.
Yes, it's an unusual to get such a sporting family that has connected two of the sports that I really enjoy, tennis and golf. So I followed Nelly and Jessica. Now Jessica's not playing anymore, but Nelly is absolutely amazing. I mean, she's world number one and recently won 5 tournaments on the trot. And there's Sebastian, who is sort of ranked about in the 20s, but he's a half-decent player and dad goes and watches his daughters and mum goes and watches his son. And it's such a lovely family atmosphere and so unique. I don't think they'll ever happen again, that you'll get these three sporting kids come up from nowhere with a dad who once won the Australian Open.
And talking about things we may not see again, we've seen Roger go. Rafa is obviously on the last legs, literally. Novak's time will come shortly, and we know Andy's is going. It's a golden era we've been lucky to see, isn't it? But will we see that again, do you think?
I don't think so. I think tennis has changed radically since those days. And I think that the fact that we could expect to see the most exciting matches with the top four in the world in many of the Grand Prix was quite something that is now unique, because I don't think we'll get that ever again. That rivalry between those four players won't exist. How can you get those four top players to constantly be battling against each other? If you look at the top players now, the youngsters coming up, the Alcaraz, Casper Ruud, Tsitsipas, even Zverev, they are not in that sort of category at the moment, where you're going to continually see them in the semi-finals and finals of Grand Slams.
No, it has been an amazing time, and you've had an amazing career. All we can wait for now is for your next story of meeting royalty, possibly not from Sweden. You seem to dominate that area. But can we just thank you, April, thank you for spending your time and explaining exactly how you got involved in tennis and this unique stance you have as the social secretary of the British Tennis Journalists Association. Thank you very much.
Thank you.